Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. Today on the show, I am so excited to have Christy Tillman on. She is the design director for the Society of Grownups. Christy, you want to say hi?
Hi.
So when I first saw the Society of Grownups website, I was really excited. The design is really pretty. The mission seemed really interesting. Tell us a little bit about what that place is before we go into all the design questions that we have for you.
So basically, Society of Grownups was founded with IDEO and MassMutual, the collaboration, and actually worked on Society of Grownups at IDEO as a project. And I loved it so much, I continued on with it after it kind of fell out of IDEO and became its own entity. And we launched back in October 2014, and I kind of came on full-time as the design director and the first designer July 2014. So Society of Grownups were basically democratizing financial literacy for kind of the 25 to kind of 45-year-old set. And the reason we're doing that is we uncovered some latent needs during the design research, that this population, you know, is up against a lot of barriers. There's a lot of student loan debt. There's different ways of work. People don't have a regular 9-to-5 like they normally do. People contract, they're entrepreneurs. There's just a lot of societal changes that kind of necessitated how to use your money to kind of facilitate your values and the kind of life you want to live. So we're on a mission to help people kind of understand how to use their money in a value-based way to kind of accomplish their life goals. There's no other really place to do that. The financial service industry in general has kind of ignored this set because they don't have a lot of money. That's really the thing.
That's the real way to put it, yeah.
Exactly. There's really no products, you know. There's some startups working on products for the kind of this set, you know, like Simple or Acorns, but it's a relatively new kind of untapped market of people who need a host of kind of financial education and financial services that kind of fit, you know, that particular lifestyle that we're kind of, us 20 to 40-year-olds are leading now. So we offer we offer classes, chat, supper clubs, guest speakers, and our classes range from anything to do with student loan debt, buying your first house, how to save for a baby, how to start your 401k, how to learn how to invest, wills and estates, you know, what happens when you die. You can also come into our space and also to get a financial appointment with a financial planner, certified financial planner. And also, we're also working on the technology side where we're coming up with some really super interesting technology tools that kind of help facilitate some of that financial education. So it's a really exciting time. We've been selling out classes like hotcakes.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. I've gotten my money together. I was not the best with money. And actually, I actually designed the first set of curriculum that we launched with. And so designing all those classes actually gave me a complete financial education. And I've saved actually quite a lot of money and also started investing heavily. So it works.
So when I think of a financial advising space, because it's a physical space, right?
Right. We have a physical space in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is a suburb right outside of Boston.
Yeah. So when I think about that, I would not intuitively think that that's a place that needs a design director, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's intuitive to me, because I'm thinking like, okay, we need money people and we need business development people, but design director doesn't come immediately to mind. What is the role of a design director in that type of financial space?
Oh, yeah, we absolutely, design is imperative to Society of Grownups. I mean, it's in the DNA. It came out of IDEO. So obviously, you know, design is super important. So one of the things we do outside of kind of the look and feel. If you come into our space, and actually if you go to societyofgrownups.com/press, there are high resolution images of our space, so you can see how beautiful it is. So one of the interesting things is when people come into our space, they say, wow, this is like no other kind of financial services place that I've ever been into. Mm-hmm. So our brand really differentiates us from, say, a Capital One or any other kind of branch, you know, bank branch that you go into. It does not look and feel like that. And yeah. So the interesting part about that is when people don't understand something or, you know, they don't kind of get a concept yet, the only thing they can judge it by is what they see. So our brand is really kind of differentiated, so right? So it invites people in, right? So the look and feel of it kind of targets, you can tell that it's for kind of a younger set. And also you can tell that we're trying to do something extremely different than any other kind of financial services place. So that's one thing. The other thing is the service model. How do we move people through the space? How do we work on our core offering? How do we level classes? How do we bundle classes together? What is the right curriculum to take people through to get a certain type of financial education? There are lots and lots and lots of question marks. We actually have a full research team, and we iterate kind of on the fly. So we sit in classes. I've sat in mini classes, observe classes. We bring people in. Our space is more of a laboratory, you could call it that, where we spend a lot of time working on our product and trying to get our service offering correct. So we iterate like crazy. Like if we notice a class isn't quite the right level, after you take a class, you fill out a survey and people say, well, this class was too easy or this is not at all what I was expecting. We can immediately, our financial planners teach most of our classes as well as people from the community who teach kind of the more lifestyle based classes, but we can immediately change a class based on the group that sat in the night before and try something new with the next group that comes in. So design is super imperative to our existence on multiple levels, from look and feel to service offering to the classroom experience. Design is everything, and that's on top of all the technology stuff that we're working on too. So
yeah, I'm looking at the I'm at the press section. I'm looking at the space. It is beautiful. And it's not only beautiful, but you're right, I would never guess that this was a financial services place. I mean, it looks more like a really fancy library cafe than anything else. I'm particularly excited about the pour over coffee that I'm seeing.
Yeah, so we come in and people kind of have an experience, you know. We want people to come in and have a relatable experience. That's kind of what we hire for, especially for our front end staff. So everyone kind of has their own financial story. The thing is, people can come in and be disarmed. Mm. Money is really hard to talk about. I mean, mm-hmm. We talk more about like our sex lives with our friends than we do money, right? You might talk with your girlfriends about XYZ, right? But you don't know how much money they make, or you don't know how much student loan debt they have. You don't know kind of those financial things. People come into the space, and one of the really great things about it is, you know, there's generally about 8 to 12 people that take a class. And that's a group of people who can all kind of say, look, we're in this space together. Obviously, we need to be here for a certain reason. What is that reason? And then you sort of see the kind of the shields come down. People become vulnerable. People will say, oh, well, I'm in $40,000 of credit card debt, or I have $100,000 in student loans. It's like, oh, me too. I'm also behind on my 401k, right? So the space is really designed to facilitate kind of community building, even down to the details of, like, we have a space called the financial therapy room. And that's the room that you go in to meet with a planner to have a 90-minute session about whatever financial topics you need to do. Well, the bathroom is located right there, so that we've designed it so that people can leave the financial therapy room, and if they need to go to the bathroom to collect themselves, that they can, because talking about money is an extremely emotional thing. Mm-hmm. It is almost never about the transaction of saving and spending. It's almost always attached to something else. So we have a huge mission in really kind of understanding. We call the people that come into our space grown-ups. So we have a huge kind of undertaking and really understanding what motivates people around their money to help them get better with it. So the design details in the space are super important. The way the classroom is designed, the glass door opens up where we can have larger events. So everything has been kind of really well thought out.
So what I think is most interesting about this is, when I think of design in the context of coding and programming, I'm thinking of you know, designing a website. But it sounds like when you're speaking about design, it's much broader and it's much bigger than that. And, you know, it surpasses maybe any specific medium. And you're talking about designing the space, but also, I'm sure, the branding and the website. So what are the different ways that you design? What are the different formats and mediums that you work in?
So as a design director, Society Grownups, I kind of touch everything. That's kind of my job. So that's kind of why you picked up on it really well that, you know, I think about the space. I actually think about the website. I think about some of the digital products we're working on. I think about the branding. I touch all of those things. Our design team is, I'm looking around, about 7 or 8 now, including UX and visual design. So we have a nice little army here of people who are really kind of working on all parts of the experience, because we're kind of different than a normal tech startup in that we do have technology, but we also have a physical product, an experience product that people need to come into. So when you think about design and coding, you know, and technology in general, yes, we have our tech stuff that you're used to, where we're, you know, doing design sprints on products and thinking about apps and all that kind of stuff too. But we also have a physical and experience product that we have to nurture too. And one of the huge challenges that we'll have is like bridging those two. So like we've gotten really well at understanding what community means in our space. But one of the things we're really trying to tackle now is how do we translate, you know, that kind of feeling to our digital products. And that's kind of one of the big things I'll probably be thinking about towards the end of this year and the beginning of next year when we're kind of getting ready to launch some of our technology initiatives.
So as the person touching all those different things, do they all come together naturally for you? Do you feel like you're going through a big cognitive shift when you are in software versus in the physical space? How do you kind of transcend all those different mediums?
That's a great question. Actually, it comes very naturally to me. And I actually credit my experience at IDEO. So I was at IDEO for 4 years in the Boston office. And I worked on just a super wide range of design projects, from designing paper rolls for 2,000 pound papers, to diabetes packaging, to apps, to service strategy and service model. So I have done all of those things at IDEO. So it was a really good place to kind of cut my teeth as a young designer and get a really good handle on thinking about, you know, different mediums to design and not really being tied to one medium. Actually, I really love digital. Like, that's my kind of first love. I'm a trained graphic designer, so I went to school for graphic design, and I did a lot of print work. And our program actually had a very strong digital component as well, but, you know, it was very print focused, to say. And so actually, going to IDEO and spending time there, I was able to really kind of broaden my perspective. And so actually, that was what made me a really good hire to be the first designer, because I could really think about all those things. Now, as we kind of grow and build out design team, and I'll be hiring a lot more to the end of this year, is, you know, people start to get a little bit more specialized. Mm-hmm. So that's the interesting thing with like startups. When you're hiring, your first 10 hires are not the same as your second 10 hires, and not the same as your third 10 hires. So, you know, you kind of want people who are generalists at the beginning, because you got to be very scrappy and, you know, you're resource limited. So you need people who can do a lot of different things. So it comes very naturally to me. As we get bigger, though, I'll probably, my kind of like sphere of influence will probably get a little bit smaller. I kind of want to spend a lot of time on the product side, because that's what interests me the most. And then we'll be hiring for someone to kind of think about the brand side more.
So IDEO is a pretty, I think, a world famous consulting firm doing design and innovation. What's been your experience like there in terms of leveling up as a designer? You said that you studied graphic design in school, and that was kind of your initial foundation. And then at IDEO, you had to do so many different things. What was it like being thrown into not graphic design at a firm like that?
Yeah, that's interesting. So right after school, I actually worked, I was a design apprentice at Reebok, and I actually worked on babies and kids' clothing. So I did all of the graphic treatments for like baby shoes and socks and kids, girls. Yeah, it was. I had my little book of glitter and studs and all the like treatments you could put. Yeah. So I actually spent a year, it was an apprentice program, I spent a year working on those kind of physical products. And then I went to Puma and I worked on the brand side. And I was a brand designer at Puma, and I did a lot of store displays and special initiatives. Like, I worked a lot on the Usain Bolt stuff. And then I went to IDEO after Puma. So I had already kind of started having initial experiences, like my first maybe year and a half, 2 years out of school. I had already kind of done a product, kind of physical thing, and then kind of more of a brand thing. So that kind of set me up to start thinking wider IDEO. The great thing about IDEO is, yes, they're world famous global consultancy, is that the level of work that comes in is unbelievable. So there's so much opportunity. And so one of the things that you have to do once you get there to be successful is to actually not necessarily specialize, but to not get overwhelmed by the amount of possibilities. So you get a chance to touch a lot of things. And to some degree, you might want to start to figure out, you know, what is it that I kind of want to get good at? So I really like education. So in general, my kind of thing philosophically is social good. So I've always kind of wanted to work on companies and initiatives that I think are changing the world in positive ways. And so that was kind of my thing at IDEO. Like, I did a lot of health projects, mental health, diabetes, and I got to do a lot of different kind of specializations under those in terms of medium. It just gave me many, many, many opportunities, like invaluable opportunities to be able to kind of become a better designer. Because of the way you work there as a flat org, and they pay a lot of attention to kind of what you want to learn. Michael Hendricks, who's the location director at IDEO Boston, where I worked, is super great about having designers say, look, this is the type of work I want to do, and how can they staff you on projects to help you kind of develop yourself in those areas. So towards the beginning, I was really kind of into social good projects, and towards the end, I started kind of working on kind of more digital things because that's kind of my interest started gravitating there. And the great thing too is you're not stuck at, like, you know, specific location. I got to work out of the Chicago office and work with the people in San Francisco. So it just gives you like just amazing breadth of work to choose from.
Yeah. So when you were working on Society of Grownups out of IDEO in the very beginning, what does that design process look like? What is the first thing that you do in that situation?
The thing is, Society of Grownups was at IDEO for 2 years, right? So there were multiple phases of the project. And the Boston studio kind of, there was like 65 people in that studio about. So pretty much everyone at some point touched a project. It began with a question, and then it came back with, well, maybe we're not asking the right question. Here's the kind of question we think we should be asking. Let's test that one. Lots and lots and lots and lots of design research, lots of traveling.
What does design research mean?
Design research means going out and talking to people and putting things in front of people to get their reaction and getting early user input. And really, you know, you can't sit at a desk. And a group of designers can't sit at a desk and come up with a solution. That's not how it ever happens. And if anyone tells you that, they're probably doing it wrong. If you're designing for people, you have to talk to them. And so
that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? It makes sense, but you would be shocked at how many companies don't do that. They literally are designing a product in a studio, and they have not talked to anyone before they invest millions of dollars in developing it. It happens all the time.
Why do you think that is? Do they just not believe it? They don't understand it?
A lot of designers kind of think they're smarter than they really are. no, seriously.
Yeah.
And they just think they know better. That's kind of a prevailing attitude that I've seen through my career. A lot of people just think they're smarter than they are. Instead of, you know, translating people's needs into products, which is more so what design research is. So, you know, you go around to different parts of the country. A lot of times you'll kind of build things for people to react to. So it's like design to build, right? And this happens in technology as well. You know, you make a prototype and you put it in front of people and basically get their reaction. And then you want to iterate on it and put it back in front of people again. So that's basically what design research is. And a lot of that happened with Society of Grownups. There were 3 full-scale prototypes built out, like completely full-scale in a warehouse with lots of classes that people would come to. We would bring people in
So you mean the physical space was built out?
Yeah, we built the physical space. There were three different versions of it, made out of foam core in a warehouse. Awesome. And yeah. we recruited people, and people would come and take classes. And we had, you know, teachers from the community to teach on the classes. And it's basically you create a lab where you can test things. Because, look, these things cost a lot of money. Like, you have to have some sort of hypothesis before you invest that kind of money into building something like Society of Grown-ups or any product. Perfectionism, without talking to people, is deadly to building anything successful.
Interesting. So I feel like one thing I've struggled with when doing – I guess customer interviews, which it sounds like is similar, if not yes. one of the tools used. Okay. So when I do customer interviews, one thing that I struggle with is that I have so much information and I'm not always sure what to do with it. Like, how do I organize it? How do I put it in the right buckets? And then how do I analyze that data and transfer it into some kind of action, right? So when you are doing these full-scale prototypes, you build out the space, people are coming in. I'm sure everyone has slightly different opinions on their experience. How do you take in all that information and transfer it into next steps?
Man, that's a big question. generally, so one of the things, interesting things you said is, you know, and that's kind of where we don't start off with I. It's usually a team, and you need a team to kind of help you decipher that. As we talk about diversity in design and tech, having a team with different lenses is kind of key to making sense a lot of the data that you'll get from customer interviews, right? So it's really a team approach of bucketing, looking for patterns. If you don't have a conclusive answer, testing something else. A lot of people think that they're going to get a eureka answer, and sometimes you just need to try again with something new. I don't really have a straightforward answer for that. It really just depends on how the process, each process that I've ever taken part in is completely organic. Sometimes a major pattern emerges is like, aha. And then sometimes it's like, okay, well, the answers are kind of muddled. Let's try something else. Usually design kind of intuition or gut is kind of also plays a huge part in that. I know with Society of Grownups and other things I've worked on, you usually test in one or two or three things, right? And one of the really key things to getting kind of decent results too is making things very divergent. Meaning if you're going to put something in front of people, that you push it really apart. They're like extremely polar opposites to make sure you elicit kind of very distinct reactions. Putting things that are like too close to each other kind of muddles the results. So there's actually a lot of planning that needs to go into the prototypes too, in order to make successful design research or successful customer interviews, especially when you're trying to like compare approaches at the beginning of kind of building products.
So how do you know that you're done? How do you say, okay, we've done this. This is the prototype that works.
That really depends on the project. It could be something as simple as time constraint. Like, look, we have 12 weeks to do this. And, you know, what you get at 10 weeks is just what you get, right? Sometimes it's money. Sometimes it's you figure out early that you see a pattern emerge. So it really depends on the constraints of the project. In a place like IDEO, lots of times you're working on the timeline of your client. And so that just naturally builds in kind of a level of done. One thing designers should really be cognizant of is to be honest with clients and say, look, this is as far as we've gotten. Sometimes we need to do another project. Look, it just 12 weeks wasn't enough. This is just really a 24-week project, right? Like this, like a Society of Grownups with a 2-year project, right? You couldn't have done it in 12 weeks or 16 weeks, which is what a typical kind of design consultancy project runs. You just have to be honest and say, look, we need more time, or we need to try this, we need to try that. And being really honest with clients about, you know, the time it takes to do like really good design work. That's super important. And even here, like, you know, we're in-house, we have our own in-house research team. We have our own tech team, we have our own design team, and, you know, when we're trying to kind of come up with concepts, it's like, look, we need more time, or look, let's just cut this off and go with what we got and put it in front of people. That's kind of the beauty of us having a lab here, too, is we can move really fast. And if we don't get it on the first try, we can try it again the next night. So we're really set up well to do kind of really quick testing to get results that way.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of code newbies are learning to code by building their own products, and they don't necessarily have a team of designers, which sounds awesome. What are some good practices, lessons learned that you can share for people that have to design their own websites and design their own product and who want to do it the right way?
I think if you don't have a design background, the simple, be simple. There seems to be kind of this trend, and I blame designers for this trend too, of over-decorating things or making things look pretty and not functional, or just not really being sensitive to how kind of the graphic intent of something gets in the way of its usability. So if you're, you know, a code newbie and you need to get a project up, the simple, the better. I know you talked to Tiffany, my co-founder of the Detroit Water Project.
Yeah.
If you saw the Detroit Water Project, the first iteration of that site was so ugly. It didn't keep anyone from donating, right? Mm. We were trying to kind of prove out a proof of concept. It didn't need to look good. So kind of this idea that, you know, you have to rush and make things have gradients and all that kind of thing, I think you should just hold off on that and just get your concept working well and really understand what the user needs. And then you can always go back and make it look beautiful. But the simpler you can keep something visually, the better, especially if you don't have a design background. Now, in terms of like usability, talking to people and helping, putting the more people you can put your thing in front of, the better. In terms of usability, and really understanding kind of how to create your product. So in terms of like design research, anyone can do that. Get your friends to use it, get your coworkers, walk out to the Starbucks. I've done that and talked to people.
How is that? Is that awkward?
There's actually a Starbucks right next to our space. And no, it's not awkward. I mean, I've done it so much that it just comes naturally.
Yeah, you're used to
it. It's usually awkward for the other person, but hey, look, can you just flip through this paper prototype on your phone? You just have to put it in front of people.
Yeah.
And in some way, it takes the pressure off, too, because you're not, like, having to have this lone genius moment, right, that people think kind of come with product building, where you, the sole creator, have come up with this genius thing, right? No, people are the input from other people are actually helping you refine that product. That's super important. So keep it visually simple and put it in front of as many people as you can to help you iterate as fast as you can would be my two tips.
So for people who don't have a design background, what are some of the most common mistakes or myths of design? You kind of talked about one of them, which is over-decoration and putting prettiness over functionality. Are there any other things that you've seen that people generally get wrong that we can watch out for?
I think people think design is only how something looks and not how it works. Mm. I think that's probably one of the biggest myths of design. What's interesting, and it kind of brings me back to a story. Here at Society of Grownups, our design team is in-house. And like you said, I don't think about a design director at a place like this. I think about financial people, right? Mm-hmm. That's the same thing that the financial people thought about Society of Grownups. It's like, this is their first time working with designers. So a lot of the interesting thing for me, you know, transitioning from IDEO to Society of Grownups is, how do I engage people who have never worked with a designer before? And how do I kind of make design accessible to people who don't have a design background? That is, like, in terms of our internal culture, those are the biggest two questions that I wrestle with daily. Because a lot of my colleagues that I work with, you know, we're iterating on how to write your will, right? I'm talking to a planner. They know all about wills. I know all about iterating. So how do we kind of marry those yeah. things together, right? So dispelling design myths, which the biggest one is, design is only about the way things look and not the way they work, is probably the biggest thing to watch out for. It's one that I wrestle with every day in helping people kind of understand, look, how does this thing work? How do people experience it? How does it make people feel? How do they get through it? Like, what are the moments that need to happen? How do the features support the experience? Those are all like big questions to ask, and not necessarily how it looks. How it looks will actually come from that, and you'll start mm-hmm. to see it shape up well if you are asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. How it looks isn't really arbitrary. It shouldn't be.
Those are really good questions. I really like those. I'm going to think about those questions afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about those questions after this.
Yeah,
think about them. Questions.
So it reminded me of an article that you may have seen called The Dribblization of Everything. Have you read this?
Oh, yeah. It came across our Slack. I don't think I read it, but I did see it and I saw the headline and I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Because dribble is like a thing and it's always been problematic to me. But to give credit to the Dribble kind of team, I think they've been really good at kind of responding to some of that feedback. So at the beginning, it was like, you know, you can't really judge a design by only how it looks. You can't judge a design in a 200 by 200 pixel box. Like, what is this, right? Mm-hmm. And now they have like full size. You can attach full size renderings and you can put a GIF. So you can probably, if you're working on something that, you know, requires motion, you can kind of show animation of how it works. So they've actually been really good at kind of responding to some of those criticisms. I still am not a Dribble person. I have an account and maybe has one screenshot on it. I haven't set up a Society of Grownups Dribble team account because I just don't think it's the right place for us to be. So yeah, I've always philosophically not been a Dribble proponent, but I do credit their team to kind of responding to some of those criticisms.
So I want to talk about something you touched on a little bit earlier in this conversation where you talked about hiring. And you talked about hiring your first 10 versus your second 10 versus your third 10. What has your experience been like hiring for Society of Grownups?
Hiring is so hard. Hiring takes a lot of time and a lot of investment and you're never done with it, but it's not your core business. And so there's always this tension about how much time do I spend hiring versus actually doing my job? Because it's, you know, it's not the core business, but it's one of the most important parts of the business. And getting to understand how someone works and thinks in, you know, in a couple of interviews is really difficult. And mishiring is, you know, can be a devastation to the team in terms of fit and kind of slowing down the team and all kinds of other problems, and even like coaching people out is difficult. So hiring is an emotional experience for me. Like, it really is. It is very much emotional to me. And I actually have to watch that because sometimes I can get drawn into candidates and their personality over like maybe, you know, how they think. And so I have to have done a lot of self-reflection on myself with the hiring experience. So even, I know I've talked about this a lot on Twitter about like, how do you kind of hire for diverse candidates? And I think our team here at Society of Grownups is pretty diverse. Actually, we've done a really good job with that. And I think I credit, you know, our CEO she's from Maine, but her family's from Bangladesh. And then, you know, I'm African-American. So when people come to Society of Grownups, you know, the potential hire, they see that we're serious about like having diversity on our team. You know, we have LGBT members and I mean, it just ranges. Our tech team has a lot of women on it. You know, we have several African-American or Black American team members, Asians. I mean, it just ranges the gamut. I think our team is very diverse and I'm very proud of that. And I credit our hiring for that. But yeah, hiring is hard. This is my first time that I actually am hiring. And it's all been on me. We don't have a recruiter, so I've actually had to do all the recruiting myself.
Are you hiring for all positions or just for the design people?
So right now we're hiring for tech. We're hiring some engineers. I think like a QA person, some mobile people. We just finished CFP hiring. We're hiring for our front staff, so our community team. And I'll be hiring for the design team really soon too. Actually, the reason why I came to the office today is to start writing job descriptions. So so hiring is very hard emotionally, and every time you add someone new to the team, the whole dynamics of the team change. That's another thing that's really, like, in a startup, it's really crazy because, you know, the CFP team, they know how to engage the design team to get what they want now. But then when you add a new person, it changes the whole dynamic of the team. Therefore, the whole company has to adjust to how they engage the team. So it's just a ripple effect when you bring someone new on. You have to be very careful about it, not to do it too fast. You have to make sure they have a proper onboarding experience. So that's something we've really been getting serious about. Like when I started Society of Grownups, our office was a closet and there were six people in it, and I walked in my
literally a closet.
It was a conference room. It was the size of the closet. No windows. It didn't have any windows.
Oh, no.
Right. And I walked in on my first day, and there was one person like, "Hi, here's your computer." You know, I was like, okay. And then when I made my second design hire, and we actually had upgraded to a place that had windows. So, and I was like, "Hey, here's your computer.
Yes. Move it up.
Download box. Here's the fonts. Design this." So he was like designing stuff on this first day, and now we've gotten really serious about how we bring people in terms of onboarding. Now people aren't doing work their first week. They're spending lots of time really understanding the company culture, meeting all the teams, meeting all the leaders, meeting all the people on the team, understanding how they will play a part in different pods. So it's really, we've been working on culture and being really serious about bringing people in as we get bigger. I mean, when I started, I was like the sixth person, and now we're at like 38.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we've gone from, and that was July to July, basically. We've gone from like 6 to 38. So.
Yeah, that's pretty fast.
Yeah.
So what has been the hardest part of hiring? Is it finding the right candidates to even apply? Is it knowing how to assess them properly? What's the toughest part about that?
The answer is yes to both of those things. Yes, finding the right candidates is very difficult. Like in terms of for design and tech, even tech too, because I remember we looked for our lead developer for like a year.
Oh, wow.
Finding the right candidate is super tough. The talent market, like if you're really talented, like you should have a wealth of choices because the market is like ripe right now. And there's a shortage of talent. Finding the right candidate is super hard. And it can be very tough because as the first designer and the design director, a lot falls on me. And I do a couple of different jobs just because, you know, we're still scrappy to some degree. And so there's a lot of pressure to like put a body in a space so that I can move on to do something else. And so being really kind of, patient, it's been very helpful. So, for example, we had a really hard time finding product designers. I don't know what's going on in Boston in particular. it's hard to pull people from the Valley. Mm-hmm. Like, who wants to leave San Francisco to move to Boston? So
there's too much snow. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. So, I was designing, like, the tech team was like, we need screens for this and we need screens for that. And I'm, like, trying to help with the service experience, right? But I'm also designing for mobile and web in the cracks, or we need to change our homepage. And it was like, oh, man. So it was really, it would have been really easy for me to hire someone for that space. I interviewed, like, man, a lot of people. And they just weren't the right fit. And we brought on our first product designer about 3 weeks ago, and I could not be happier with her. She's amazing. And I was like, wow, my patience finally paid off. We have this amazing, she's just come in and just really kind of just elevated the level of design and her contributions. And so really finding the right person is super stressful. And yes, and assessing them is hard too, because sometimes you can sit next to someone and their cracks don't show for 2 or 3 months, and you have to really kind of figure it out in the interview. That's what you're supposed to do, but you know, that's super hard. So, how do you assess designers? And I've been debating too, whether I want to start doing design projects. You know, that's kind of a hot topic in the design community. Should you make candidates do a design project? To kind of see how they think, because it's really easy to hide a lot of stuff in your portfolio. So yeah, assessing talent is super hard too. I actually think I've done a great job. I'm really super happy with the designers on our team. They're absolutely amazing designers. And we have a very good kind of balance and relationship. So I'm getting better at it as the more I do it. So I'll probably be hiring probably another 8 or 9 people within the next year or so. So I'll keep doing that. You know, being patient and just really kind of just sticking it out. I'm committed to kind of also to making sure I get a broad range of candidates. So in terms of like making sure our team, like on our team right now, we only have one white male designer on our team. Well, two. On the UX side, there's one. And then on the visual design side, there's one. So we have a lot of ladies and we have a lot of non-white people on our team. And I think that's just kind of a natural result of me being the design director. I think people say, oh, look, okay, you know, I can come here. So one of the design positions I actually had four Black American candidates, you know, like, how does that happen? Even when people claim they can't find Black people to interview for tech jobs. But so, yeah, I'm also committed to making sure we get a breadth of experience and a breadth of kind of candidates to apply.
So how were you able to do that? Because you're right. Everyone says that. Everyone says it's hard to find good people. And then trying to find good people who are also diverse in however you define that is like an additional hurdle. So how did you manage that?
Right. So here's the funny thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, I do now because I interviewed them. But before that, I don't know 4 Black female designers. I have 2 Black female design friends, and those are the ones I know. And then I know like one more that I worked with at another place, and that's it. So, yeah, that's the extent of it. And so, it was really like, I asked one of them, like, look, I want to broaden kind of the pool of people I'm looking at. Send me people you know. So I spent a lot of time asking people to ask people to ask people. And it's interesting. I got that from Gary Chow, who runs the Orbital program in New York City.
Yeah, Gary's awesome.
Gary came to me and said, look, we need some more African-American women to apply for our program. Who do you got? And so I was able to send people that I knew. And I was so glad that he asked because that's just not his wheelhouse, right? And he was like, look, I need your help. So I took that same approach. I was like, look, I need you guys. I know they exist because I listen to Revision Path, right? So I know we're out there.
They're somewhere. I just don't know them.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I used my network and it just started pulling people in. And so I did get one hire out of that bunch. Actually, they were all super talented. If I could hire them all, I would have. And so it was just really using my network to extend my reach. The interesting part about that, though, and one of the things that hiring has done to me is to reflect on kind of when we talk about kind of diversity in design and diversity in tech, what are we asking people to do? So we say, you know, we want to interview a broad range of folks, but the application process is actually designed to filter folks. And there's business constraints, right? You only have a certain amount of time to look at portfolios. Look, I can look at a portfolio in 20 seconds until I want to talk to a designer. And that's how long it takes me. I get tons of emails all the time and I can look through them and say, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes. And that's all the time I have. I'm a very busy person. If you look at my calendar, it's completely blocked for the next 2 weeks. So, but I had to actually take time and be very intentional about reaching out to my network and saying, look, help me do this. And so I've been actually wrestling with this because the application process is about filtering. But if you want diverse candidates, it's really about opening up the process. And what are the business implications of that? That's actually something I'm wrestling with too. Because if me as a Black woman is saying, look, I had to do all this work to find these candidates, when you're asking white guys to do that, what does that mean for them? And I wonder what kind of barriers exist there. And when we talk about, you know, broadening the scope. So that's something I'm like wrestling with now. I should probably write something about it to help me figure out my thoughts. But
yeah, please do.
It was just an interesting process. I'm like, look, we're supposed to be filtering people. And here I'm asking more people to apply and spending more time to try to find people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a hard ask. It really is. Mm-hmm. So
what can, I guess, candidates do to make that easier? Because part of it is, you know, you're trying to widen the net and find people, but people also need to be findable, right? So what can people, whoever they are, whatever they look like, how can they make themselves easier to find?
That's a great question. be on any of the major kind of portfolio sites. So one of the things that I spent time actually went to Dribbble, shame on me. But I did.
After all that.
But usually people have their full portfolio link, so I could go to that. I spent time on Behance. So being on any of those major sites, basically making yourself visible is going to be probably the number one thing that you can do. Yeah, because that's kind of what I started to do. Be visible. Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, other than not like self-selecting with applications, I guess that's another thing.
That is a big one.
Yeah.
That is a big one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was actually having that conversation on Twitter the other night. Is people of color, marginalized people, we tend to self-select. We tend to say, if we don't meet every single check mark on a job description, then we shouldn't apply because we already feel like we're at a disadvantage. So if we're not 100% fitting kind of the profile, we won't apply. Versus white guys will say, look, I meet 20% and I'm entitled to this job, so I'm going to apply. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking very generally, right? So don't like tweet me negative things for saying this. So I'm just speaking very generally.
Yes.
Right. So not self-selecting, applying for a position that you might not necessarily fit the role. If it says 3 to 5 years and you don't have two, still apply. Let them tell you no. That's kind of a really big one. Because here's the thing. With job descriptions, like, they're a general kind of filtering tool. But look, I put out a job description for a product designer that has 3 to 5 years experience. And I just hired someone who graduated from school, right? She starts in a couple of weeks. And she literally just graduated. And I looked at her portfolio. And I talked to her. And she blew us away. Hmm. So, you don't, like...
Good for her for applying.
Yes, exactly. She applied. And I ended up talking to her. And actually, she has a good tech background. She actually won the presidential kind of scholarship at her school to build her app, her senior thesis app, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this girl's built like apps, right? And she applied. So self-selecting is probably the number one thing you shouldn't do. Let people tell you no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a huge one.
Yeah, that one is so hard. I think it's harder for code newbies in particular because you're already self-conscious about the fact that you don't have a CS degree or a design degree. Like, you don't have that formal training. You're self-taught, or maybe you did online classes.
Right.
And then on top of that, a lot of the work you do isn't vetted or validated by someone else, right? So if you're in school, your professors will tell you that it's terrible. You know, your peers will criticize you. But when you're on your own, you really don't know how good you are. And
that's
so
a good point.
Yeah, feeling confident in your own work and then also reading the job description that's just so far away from where you are. Like, there's just so many emotional, mental barriers to jump before you can get to the point where you hit submit. How do you get through all those barriers?
That's a really good point. Yeah. That's an excellent point. I'm actually considering that, and this is just based on a conversation I had on Twitter literally like the other night. Is how do we write job descriptions to help people get over that? So I plan to actually experiment with job descriptions on this next round. I have some kind of ideas. I don't want to put them out there yet, but about how to write job descriptions and open it up better for people to kind of get over those barriers. So that's like an excellent point. If you're self-taught, it's really hard to kind of know like where you fall on the meter. I wonder if people should spend some time. When I was in design school, I did a lot of informational interviews. So I went to design school
those.
In Kansas City, right? Yeah. And so I would go to a couple of agencies. Went to a couple of agencies and had informational interviews and no job opening. But they would sit down with me and with usually a creative director or someone and look at my book and kind of give me some kind of advice. So I wonder if people, some of the code newbies, could reach out to some kind of senior people and just, you know, get some reads, you know, every couple of months or after every project about kind of where that project falls in the spectrum. So that when they're applying, they have a little bit more confidence about their application. I mean, maybe that's a kind of a strategy. And, you know, more senior people could open themselves up and make themselves available to talk to people. That's something we can do on our side too, to kind of help those people. Because, yeah, you're right. It's a huge emotional thing. And also, too, hearing no, right, is kind of emotional, too. Like, you're, like, getting rejection. So how do you let people down the right way? That's something else I've been thinking about, too. Like, what is a brand experience for kind of, like, letting candidates know that they're not the right fit at that particular time?
I love that you think of it as a brand experience.
Oh, that's great. It's solely a brand experience. You know, one of the things is you might want to hire that person later on. You might want them to be a customer. Yeah, our second design hire actually applied for my job. He wasn't the right fit. But then it was like when it was time for us to have another, like, my boss was like, look, you need help. I was like, yes, I do. Right. I called him up and said, look, you know, I know you interviewed for my job, but we're at this place now. And, you know, he's on board here. So, you know, you just never know what your interactions with people are going to be later on. In the tech world and design world are super small. Like, so you can't be really screwing people over and treating them bad because you're going to run into them at a conference or something else, you know. So it's definitely a brand experience.
Yeah. And that advice, doing informational interviews, that's when I give all the time. You know, I tell people, find a developer or a designer, whoever it is that you want to be, you know, the role that you want to have. Find them on Twitter, Google them, and ask them out for coffee and just say, what's your job like? How did you get there? And get those, you know, those data points before you're ready to apply, and then work through them, right? You walk out with a list of action items that you can work on. And use that to be a better candidate when you're actually ready to apply.
Totally. Twitter and LinkedIn to me are like those are unbelievable resources. I mean, I came to design. I went to business school first. And my parents pushed me to business school right out of high school. And so I actually did some internships. I was a tax account intern for a huge pharmaceutical company. And then I interned, I was a budget analyst intern at NASA for the space station group. And that's actually how I found design.
Oh, wow.
I was on an internet message board, and I met this guy who was a designer at Nike. And I was like, holy crap.
good catch.
Yeah, holy crap. You can do art for, like, money, because I was a big art nerd in high school. I spent 4 years in the studio, and no one ever told me about design. Imagine that. I was like, holy crap, you can do this cool art on shoes for money? And that's actually how I became a designer. So I actually taught myself Photoshop after meeting him, and then I realized I hit a wall, and I couldn't get any better. And so I was like, you know what? I was in a five-year MBA program, and I got out of the five-year MBA program. And went to design school. I did a short stint in graduate school so that I could get my portfolio together, and then I went to design school. So that's actually how I got to design school. Like, I wasn't born a designer. Like, and so there's a lot of kind of hustle involved. And I think people, you know, code newbies who are like hustling to teach themselves how to code that's actually a huge advantage. If you're the kind of person who is starting from scratch and you're willing to go through it in a untraditional manner, you already kind of have an advantage. So like when I got to design school, I was a little bit older than the kids there, just because I had spent time in undergrad before, but I knew exactly why I wanted to be there, right? And I had already taught myself stuff before I got there. And so people are like, what is this? And you know, I didn't tell a ton of people about my background either, so they didn't know. So they're like, whoa, this person is super motivated. Like, I had really good, not to like brag on myself, but I had really good internships when I was in design school. And when I graduated design school, I had a portfolio that had no school projects in it. I had interned at Converse and Payless, and I had all projects that had been in the public. So when I came out of design school in 2009, when the economy sucked, actually my second intern at Converse, they called me a week before and said that they couldn't afford to pay me, so they had to cancel my internship. That's how bad the economy was.
No.
So I actually had a job. It was me and a few other people graduated with jobs. Because my portfolio had no school projects in it. So if you have that kind of hustle, and not to say people who go to school don't have hustle, but it takes a certain kind of person who's willing to kind of go out on a limb and teach themselves and be self-taught. So you already have a level of hustle. So if you can use things like Twitter and LinkedIn to kind of further your hustle in terms of networking, in terms of putting your projects in front of people, you should continue to do that, because that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you can't be bought. So, you know, I had some of that too. You know, I decided to go back to school because I just felt like I couldn't get any better. And not to say, you know, any of the code newbies need to do that. I just felt like I needed to do that. I need to buy myself some time to get really good at my craft. But yeah, I mean, I had I was doing really bad websites for people for $50 before that. I actually included my first website that I built in my application at IDEO. I was like, look how bad I was. And look at where I am now, you know? So it was just like, it was really, when I look at something, it was really horrible. But, you know, I was putting it out there and I actually was making a little money off of it. And so, you know, that level of hustle, if you can have that, and people, I'm sure code newbies have that just because of who they are. It's like, use that hustle to kind of further push yourself, to put yourself in front of people, like you say, to ask people for coffee, or ask people to look at your GitHub or whatever it is you have. Put your stuff out there. And that's the same thing with the Detroit Writer Project, right? Put stuff out there. People can only react to it negatively or positively. Nothing will happen to you. You won't die. Just put your work out there and get responses. Yeah. Like, that's the best thing you can do.
And once you do that the first time and you realize the world did not end, it's so much easier the next time and the next
time
and the next
time.
So
true. It's so true. It really is. It's like you build momentum. And you also get a confidence boost from that.
Definitely. So hustle, is that one of the things that you look for in a designer?
Yes.
When you're hiring?
Yeah. It's not enough to know, like, programs. Like, when, as society of grown-ups, we're building something that does not exist. And that means we don't have a blueprint for it. And so people have to really be able to figure stuff out. There's still a level of scrappiness that we have because we're not we're not making money yet. We're not super rich, right? And so we have to be able to be very, 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 very resourceful. And resourcefulness to me is like the hallmark of a designer. Like if I say, well, we need to do XYZ and you've never done it before, you have to be able to figure out how to do it. And to me, that is like one of the top three skills I would look for in a designer, is being able to be resourceful without a lot of handholding. And I think the Code Newbie audience, just from some of the people I've interacted with online, yourself and some other folks that I know are involved with Code Newbie, we all should have that. And you know what? I think Black women in particular kind of have that hustle naturally just because of our experiences. And I think that's something we should also draw upon as a strength, you know, when we're applying to places or we're in the workplace. We just have a natural hustle because of our shared experience. So it just comes naturally to me to kind of just figure stuff out. And I look for people who have that as well, like figure it out. That's like the biggest thing in any startup, is you have to be able to figure stuff out that you've never done before and not be afraid to do that.
So when we are looking for jobs, it's a two-way street, right? The company, the person who's doing the hiring, needs to vet us, but we also need to vet the company. We also need to make sure that that's a place that we want to work at and that's going to nurture us and help us grow, especially if we're looking for our first design job or our first developer job. What are some things that we can do to find the right fit in the company?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at any company's page, I immediately go to the team page. The team page and see who these people are. Google them. Look at their Twitter. Look at their LinkedIn. Seriously, like almost every company now has a team page. And if they don't, you can also go to LinkedIn, because chances are you can go to their company page and see everyone who works there.
That's exactly the second thing I do. Yep.
Google those people.
I look
people.
At the team page first. If they don't have it, I go to LinkedIn. I search the company name. I find all the employees. Who are these people? What have they done? Yes.
Exactly.
That's exactly my process.
Yeah. So do that research. Who are those people? And if you can talk to anyone that's ever worked with them, I would do that. And I would even ask those questions in the interview. Like, that's another kind of red flag to me, is when people kind of in an interview don't have many questions. Just like, okay, do you kind of know why you're here? Do you kind of know what you're looking for? Exactly. And I try to be really transparent. Like, look, we're working hard. Sometimes you're going to have to put in some long hours, but we do try to keep work-life balance. You know, I'm really transparent. And I'm also very invested in helping develop designers. And so if you come work with me, that's something like I'm into, and I usually say it in the interview, but most people aren't going to be forthcoming about that. So you kind of have to ask those questions. Ask the questions you want to know, and don't be afraid. And if you're asking tactful questions about, How do you develop people here? What is the mentorship like? If people like don't want to answer those questions, it's probably not a place you want to work anyways. So yeah, you really should do research on those folks. Follow them on Twitter. Even if you don't interact with them, just see what kind of person they are. There's never been a time before the level of transparency of like knowing who people are, knowing what people are about before you even meet them. It's so much easier now than before. So there's kind of really no excuse to not do at least some rudimentary kind of research on those folks.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. So next, let's move on to some rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Sure.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
To stay at a job that I wasn't learning, growing, or didn't feel like I fit at just because it was prestigious.
Ooh, tell me about that.
So, you know, when you're thinking about kind of your next career moves, when I was personally thinking about mine and what I wanted to do in terms of like leaps I've made from different companies, people telling me that, you know, I should stay certain places just because of what that place could do for me and kind of ignoring some of the other concerns I had. I feel like if you don't feel like you fit at a place or you don't feel like you're growing or learning, then you should leave. It doesn't matter the name of the place or who's there or who isn't there. Not being really tied to kind of prestige or any of that. You're going to get a good experience at small places, large places. It's really about what you make of the place. So, you know, keep moving if you feel like you need to keep moving. Don't let anyone tell you to stay somewhere that you don't feel like you should be. And you get that gut feeling quickly and you should just follow it.
Yeah, another version of that I hear all the time is to stay at a place because it's only been a year.
Oh, or, yeah, that's another one.
A certain amount of months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's a totally
another one. How do you
feel
about that
one? I disagree. I know it makes it rough when you're interviewing you in your resume is like 8 months here, 7 months there. I mean, I totally get why people want to avoid that, but I think you learn really quickly whether you need to be at a place or not, and I think you should do something about it. I think people of color know quickly too, and we should move on from places that where we don't feel like we belong. I strongly believe that it is so crushing to be at a place where you kind of feel like you don't fit. And having had that experience, I felt like I had left an abusive relationship. And so now I'm just like, I would never advise someone to stay somewhere they feel like they didn't fit. It's just too emotionally damaging.
Number two, the first coding project I built was...
So I did this project called Black Cool with Shawn Morrison, and her Twitter is at XIANAMOY. We actually met on Twitter and we created this thing called Black Cool. Rebecca Walker did the book Black Cool. And we created like this Pinterest thing where Black people could upload photos of Black people being cool as an inspiration and a supplement to that book. So that was the kind of first kind of scrappy little coding project I did with her. It might still be up. It was really kind of not great, but it was like, you know, the first kind of foray into throwing something out on the internet and just seeing how people responded. We had quite a bit of uploads and people kind of really responded to it well, but from a design perspective, it wasn't that great.
Oh.
But, I mean, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from it. It was one of those things where you kind of learn a lot, even though the product isn't super great, you know. And it was kind of the pre-forerunner to kind of Detroit Water Project in that I wasn't scared to just throw something onto Twitter anymore. It's like I had already done that, so.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did that help you as a designer and as a product person grow?
Yeah, so knowing what's really bad, knowing something's bad, but also just
helpful.
It's very helpful. Knowing what you don't want to do is super helpful. But yeah, just not being afraid to put something out. Also, too, like just being resourceful and getting things done quickly. I think me and Sean did that project in like a week or two. Over a couple of weekends.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nothing.
So, yeah. So it was just, you know, just tinkering. There's a lot to learn from tinkering, even if the product isn't great, so.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to design is?
The range of possibilities for design. So I like I said earlier, I went through a graphic design program, but if I had done more research, and maybe it was the timing wasn't good in terms of when I started design school, but I probably would have done interaction design or maybe even industrial design. So like knowing all the possibilities that you can do with design is something I wish I had known before. So my career has kind of been interesting. Like I've gone from like shoe internships, and I worked at Puma and Reebok and all that, IDEO, when I did like health stuff. So I've like knowing that all of that existed before, I would have done some different type of planning.
Makes sense. So let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Sure. So the first one is Designer News, which is designernews.co, which is kind of where I hang out to kind of keep abreast of all the design kind of world updates. It's kind of like, I would say the design version Hacker News, but it's also much nicer community.
Good.
And then Revision Path, which is a project by Maurice Cherry, which Maurice is an awesome guy. He's on the diversity community for AIGA, which is a National Association for Design. But Revision Path, they do podcasts with Black designers and Black coders. So if you kind of are interested in kind of that world and want to, you know, expose yourself to a lot more people that you might not know exist, they are there and thriving. And so Revision Path is a really great site. And then Cap Watkins, blog.capwatkins.com. Cap is the VP of design at BuzzFeed, and his blog is amazing. He writes a ton on design leadership, team building, and management, and I read his blog religiously because he's very insightful and very succinct. And so as you know, it's a budding designer leadership, yeah, it's something I quickly can read and get lots of insight about, like how to be a best design leader. So those are my shout outs. Thank you.
Those are great shout outs. I like those.
Thanks.
And I have a couple shout outs of my own. One is, so we recently launched a front end roundup. So we've been doing these resource roundups, kind of weekly links and things that we like, and we just added a new version of that, and specifically on front end and design. And one of our community members who's leveling up as a front end developer, Nikki Hernandez, who's amazing and been a really big part of the Kunubi community for a while, she's going to take the lead on that. And so I definitely would love for you all to check out her recommendations on everything from design stuff and UX and UI to actually front-end development. So definitely take a look at that. The second is a YouTube video called If Google Was a Guy. Christy, have you heard of this?
I have not. My interests are peaked. My ears peaked.
Yes. I love when I know YouTube videos that other people don't know. Because that never happens. So this was done by, I think it was College Humor, and they have it's a three-part series, and it's really, really funny. So Google is characterized as, he kind of looks like a college professor, like a typical kind of, you know, college professor in a room with lots and lots of papers and basically your search results. And it's funny because it's really kind of making fun of the users, and it's making fun of the things that we search and how we try to adjust the searches when things don't come out the way we want. And it's so, so brutally honest and really, really funny. So definitely check that out. I've only seen part one, but I assume part two and part three are just as funny.
Okay, so I'm going to check that out as soon as we're done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Christy, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.